Once again, it is good to see all of you this morning. I am delighted that you're here. Thank you for venturing out to come to church today. And those of you who are visiting with us this morning, we're delighted that you're here as well. Thank you for making this your place of worship this morning. We are happy to be together again. My wife and I this week took a few days and went to South Florida to visit our children and grandchildren. We really went to see the grandkids, don't care about the kids so much. And those of you who are grandparents, you know what I mean by that. And as we were there, I discovered something. I discovered that grandparenting is exhausting. It is exhausting. If you've ever tried to chase a 4 and a half around at the age of 30, you can pull it off. At the age of 60, it's like trying to chase a fly. It's an exhausting thing, but it's a wonderful nonetheless. Our little granddaughter, Hannah, is much smarter than I am, even at this age. And she's thinking of things already that I didn't think of at the age of 4, I'm sure of that. So it was tough keeping up with her, mentally, physically, emotionally, and the list goes on and on. Now, I tell you that for no other reason than just to brag. Actually, no, I tell you that because I was thinking about something else in the midst of all this. You know, there's an old adage that says, with age comes wisdom. You've probably heard that at some point, right? With age comes wisdom. And I've now come to realize that that statement is utterly false. And not just because we went to grandparents and went to our grandchildren to visit with 4 and a half year olds, but because it seems to me that age does not, in fact, equal wisdom. I've seen a lot of old men in the last few years of my life who are clearly not wise. They may be old, but they don't necessarily say smart things. Greater age in a fallen world does not equal true wisdom. It just equals a collection of experiences within a fallen world, which might lead to some sense of doing things right, quote unquote, once in a while, but it isn't necessarily wisdom. It becomes, in fact, only greater shortcomings of understanding in this world, which is what leads us to the last bit of James 3, the last few verses of the chapter, which we're not even going to be able to finish this morning, but nonetheless, it helps us to think about what it is that James is trying to say. Now, let me remind you where we are at. In the letter of James, James is deeply concerned about one thing. He is deeply concerned about those who claim to be Christian living consistently with what they believe. I mean, if you had to pick a theme out of this book, that's it. If you had to write a thesis of what this book is about, the very simple phrase is, James is concerned that those who claim to be followers of Jesus, those who claim to be Christians, live their lives consistently with what has been revealed in the gospel. That's it. In the first half of the letter, he defines this idea of faith. What is faith? What does it mean to actually trust in Christ? But then in the second half of the letter, starting in chapter 3, he turns his attention to the transformative effect of faith. His argument is, if faith is real, then it has a transformative effect upon your life. It doesn't just come into your mind as something you profess with words, but it comes into your soul as that which affects the entirety of your existence. And you remember he started the chapter, the first 12 verses of that chapter, with a discussion of language, of how we speak, as one of the most fundamental transformations that occurs in the life of a Christian. A Christian speaks differently than a non-Christian. A Christian has a language that's clearly different from the rest of the world. But then, the last paragraph of the chapter, starting in verse 13, James turns his attention to the nature of knowledge and understanding, this idea of wisdom, as I mentioned a moment ago. the nature of understanding, the nature of knowledge. And in the midst of this, he is arguing that we show our faith by how we apply what has been revealed to us, particularly in the way that we relate to other people, particularly in our interpersonal relationships. Faith for James then isn't just words coming out of our mouth, even good words coming out of our mouth, but a transformed understanding of ourselves and others. Wisdom. You remember he started with a rhetorical question. Who is wise and understanding among you? And of course the assumption is, well, we all are as those who follow Christ, because those who follow Christ should understand and have knowledge of what it is that God has revealed to us. Then he gives us an imperative in the second half of verse 13 that the believer is to walk in the meekness of wisdom. He is to demonstrate his faith in God by how he applies what he knows from God. How do you take what you know and apply it? That's the command. Then, as we looked at last week in verses 14 to 16, he contrasts the wisdom of the Christian heart with the nature of the wisdom of the world, the wisdom of the world around us, the wisdom in the mind and the heart of the unbeliever. And remember, I pointed out that one of the key elements of this so-called wisdom is that human beings believe that they are autonomous beings, that they're not dependent upon anybody or anything. The greatest aspect of the fall is that it made men believe that they are autonomous creatures. Autonomous beings, rather, not creatures. Autonomous beings. And they see others as nothing more than evolved animals. Hateful beings of which they are jealous, resulting in every form of evil perpetrated between and against them in all manner of selfish ambition. And James says that kind of wisdom, that kind of thinking is utterly inconsistent with what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. To embrace the wisdom of God is to embrace something entirely different from that, which then leads us to verses 17 and 18, where now James will turn back to the wisdom of God, and he'll make an application here. He's going to give to us in these last two verses the nature of godly wisdom. The nature of godly wisdom that should permeate the heart and mind of every person who claims to trust in Christ. What you will notice here is that these two verses are an application of the imperative of the second half of verse 13. These are the characteristics of those who do the work of wisdom as they demonstrate their faith in God. Here's what wisdom is. This is what true wisdom looks like. This is how it works itself out in real life. The imperative is walk in the meekness of wisdom. The application is here's the details. Here's what that means. This is what it looks like. This is how it's characterized. In verse 17, James writes, but the wisdom from above, notice the but. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Now, we need to start, of course, with the first bit of that which says the wisdom from above. But the wisdom from above. Now we have to stop and think about that phrase for a second. The wisdom from above. The wisdom from above is defined as the revelation given by God from above. But it's more than just revelation. It is revelation that is applied well, wisely. Is the key, right? Applied well by those who receive it. What God reveals as to his intentions in the world, applied consistently by his own. Let me say that again. It is the revelation, the wisdom from above, is the revelation given by God, that is from above, that is applied well, wisely. Okay, see the two words, wisdom from above. It is from above because it's revealed by God, and it is applied well, which means that it is a wisdom. And it's applied by those who receive it. Now, I could just insert an entire sermon right there to talk about who receives it. But the answer to that question should be obvious from the context of the book. Who is James writing to? He's writing to believers. He's writing to followers of Christ. So he's saying, you followers of Christ, this is what you are supposed to apply. You are the ones that have received it. Who is wise and understanding among you? You are. Since you are to apply these things wisely. God has revealed his intentions in the world, and you are to apply that consistently in all things. Now, notice that this is contrasted with verse 15, as we looked at last week. Now, James doesn't use these two words, but it seems obvious here, doesn't it? The wisdom from below. The opposite of wisdom from above is wisdom from below. The kind of wisdom that he called earthly, right? The kind of wisdom that he called unspiritual, even demonic, right? I said, remember last week, that it's the kind of wisdom that bubbles up from the depths of hell. It doesn't come down from heaven, it comes up from hell. It comes up from the devil, the father of lies, who sends out information into the world that is false, which people then believe and think they're being wise. It is a wisdom from below. More specifically, it is an understanding of the world based on the lie whispered by Satan that human beings are autonomous creatures, free from the whims of a creator, able to set their own destiny. Right? Go read Genesis 3 and what Satan said to Eve. That is exactly what he said. He said to her, you can be an autonomous creature, you can be an autonomous being, free from the whims of a creator, and you are able to set your own destiny. And Eve believed him and ate from the tree. So this is not wisdom from below, this is wisdom from above. And wisdom from above, and the key word that we really need to think of here, is that wisdom from above is revelation. Okay? Wisdom from above is revelation. That is a key understanding of the concept of wisdom from above. Where does it come from? It comes from above. It doesn't come from this world. It comes from someplace else, which implies that it has to be revealed. We don't just walk around and find it. There is no tree of wisdom that we just walk over and eat from. No, it must be revealed to us by God. But here's the thing. It is not intuition. It's not analysis. It's not experience. It's not observation. And oh, might I scream this from the rooftops, it is not feelings. It's not how you feel. It is revelation. It is knowledge coming from God that is not based on intuition or analysis or experience or observation or feelings. It is not gleaned by the scientific method of observation and analysis and experimentation. It comes by revelation. God makes this wisdom known. Let me just do a little thought experiment with you for a second. Imagine, if you will, that Jesus, the human Jesus, left his Father's throne and came to your dining room and sat at your dining room table. What do you think he would want to talk about? If you had the opportunity to invite the Lord Jesus, the man, to step down, come to your dining room and sit across. You offered him a nice hot cup of tea or a cup of coffee or whatever it is he likes drinking. Served him a small snack and decided to have a conversation. What would you talk about? What do you think he would want to talk about? Now, let me point out to you how you answer that question reveals a great deal about what you think the Christian religion is all about. Okay? Because what your mind first goes to in terms of the topic of conversation will tell you a great deal about what you think Christianity is all about. Now, I know there's probably many of us would want to say, well, I would love to really sit down and talk to Jesus about all of this, you know, social justice and racism and pandemic and poverty and all these other things that are going on in the world all around us. And I want to get some answers as to how we're supposed to solve these things, what we're supposed to do and all these sorts of things. I imagine that the vast majority of Christians, in fact, would go down that path. I want to talk to Jesus about the problems in the world, or more specifically, my problems, my issues. You know, the bank account just doesn't have as much in it as it needs, or the car in the driveway is failing, or the job just isn't going as well as it could, or the kids are a nightmare, or the list goes on and on, right? How many of us would find ourselves being tempted to want to have a conversation with Jesus about all these sort of temporal matters? It tells you a great deal about what you think about the Christian religion as to how you would answer that question. That's why I phrased the question as I did. What would he want to talk about? I mean, it might get a point in the conversation where Jesus would go, stop, stop, stop. I don't want to talk about any of that. Because here's the thing, my friend. You're going to be dead in a few years, and none of that's going to matter anymore. And it might be, for some of you, it might be a lot longer than just a few years, Lord willing. But nonetheless, all of these things are temporary. So let's not talk about those things. Let's talk about things that really matter. Let's talk about eternal things. Or more specifically, let's talk about your sin, shall we? Now that's the point, of course, where we push back from the table and say, well, it's been nice seeing you. Thank you for coming. Here's the front door. But the fact of the matter is that the Christian religion isn't about these temporal matters. It really isn't. All of those temporal matters find their answers within the larger framework of the matters of eternity. There's a little circle of temporal matters, and there's a much bigger circle of eternal matters that surrounds it. Think about this. Look at the gospel accounts. Read through the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. And see what it is that Jesus talked about. What did he talk about? Was he terribly worried about how well Caesar was running the police department in downtown Rome? Was there any discussion of that? Was there any discussion of Jesus about the political ramifications of the upcoming election, of which there was none? Was there any discussion of any of those sorts of things? You look at the New Testament accounts of Jesus speaking with his disciples, and you get the very distinct impression that Jesus is only interested in the eternal realities of their lives, not the temporal. Because he knows they're temporal. They're not eternal. The human experience, quote unquote, the human experience, from a biblical perspective, has little to do with all these temporal matters. It has much to do with the primary issue facing humanity. And the primary issue facing humanity isn't all these other issues. It is our broken relationship with our Creator. Everything else flows from that. Our broken relationship with our Creator resulting in a failure to acknowledge Him, followed by gross idolatry permeating us. It is not primarily about our happiness in this world. To join yourself with the Christian religion is not to join yourself with a spirituality that's going to make you happy. Quite the contrary. It is to join yourself with a man who looks you in the face across your dinner table and says, take up your cross and follow me. See, the church that abandons revelation at its core quickly spirals away to a focus on secondary matters. When the church abandons the idea of revelation at its core, when it abandons the idea that God has spoken and made known His intentions in the world, when the church abandons that and it spirals away into nothing more than a fascination with secondary matters. And ironically, its people abandon the church. They walk away. And you know why they walk away? Because when the Church of Jesus Christ focuses on temporal matters, it becomes irrelevant. Nobody cares. Because autonomous beings look at a church that's only talking about temporal matters and says, "You can't tell me what to do. You have no authority over me." And the people perish. Wisdom from above, James's contention is that wisdom from above is revelation. It is given to us in the Scriptures, being specifically about the person and work of the Son, and interpreted for us by the Holy Spirit as He applies it to our existence in this fallen world. The Bible is about God's plans to accomplish His purposes in the world through His Son, Jesus Christ, and that is applied by the Spirit to us as we live in anticipation of eternity, not with our eyes fixed and focused here. This is profound. Those three little words, wisdom from above. The wisdom from above? Those are the kinds of words that should challenge your thinking every day. It really should. What is the wisdom from above? What is God's thoughts? What does God think? It is irrelevant what I think. It is irrelevant what you think. It is irrelevant what some sage out here thinks. All that matters is what God thinks. Because in the end, He's going to accomplish His purposes in all things. And it's going to be irrelevant about what we think along the way. God's going to look at us and go, "You know, it didn't matter one bit that you wrote that Facebook post. It didn't change a thing. You tweeted that, but who cares? The 17 followers that you had did not change the world." It is what God thinks that is important. That's where James starts. The wisdom from above is revelation. What God has said. What has He said into this world? That's what we should be pursuing. That's what we pursue. We should be spending a lot more time, in other words, with our noses in the Bible than with our faces in the TV or in the internet. Now, notice what he says. Look exactly how he puts this here. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then a list. Okay, now I want you to notice that. It is first then. The Greek phrase, the Greek phraseology here is a proton men followed by another word that means then, epita. It is a conjunctive. In the English language, we call it a conjunctive. It is a conjunctive of order, placing one thing first and then other things to follow from it or connected to it in a subordinate fashion. We translate it first this, then that. It's similar to the idea of if X, then Y. As a programmer, I do a lot of if-then statements because that's how you make computers do what you want it to do. If this is true, then you do this. If it's not true, then do this. If-then is the same idea, or both this and that. But in this particular way, the way that James uses it, he is explicitly, I think, using this language to order the list of items that follow. Okay? The wisdom from above is first one thing And that's the most important thing. And then all the others flow from it. They're secondary to the first one. So he says it's first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, etc. Right? Okay, so it's very important that you get that order, because I think he's explicitly making the point that the first one is the genesis of all the others. That you must have first one thing, then you can have all the others. If you don't have the first, all the others don't exist. All right? So James considers the wisdom of God to first be pure with all of its other attributes subordinate to that purity. Purity is the basis of all of the elements of wisdom. Without purity, the rest mean nothing. So it's first pure, then it's other things. Now let me point out the obvious here from what we talked about last week. The wisdom of this world cannot start with purity. It cannot. Why? Because there's nothing pure in this world. Everything is corrupted. Every aspect of this universe has been corrupted by the fall. There is no thought, there is no fact, there is no detail anywhere that is pure, perfect, and unadulterated or uncorrupted in this world. So the wisdom of this world cannot start from purity. It does not start with purity because its source is fallen. Which means if you start from a source that is impure, guess what you're going to have? You're going to have a stream of knowledge and understanding that is corrupted all the way to the end. And what happens when it starts corrupted is that as it goes out, it becomes more and more corrupted as it goes. So it isn't starting, the world's knowledge, the world's wisdom, the world's understanding isn't starting from a place that is pure, it is starting from a place that's impure. James is making that point specifically and importantly. I'll give you one example. It's a fundamental flaw in something known as evidential apologetics. I'm a Vantillian presuppositional apologist. If you don't know what that is, look it up. A Vantillian presuppositional apologetics. The form of apologetics that's most favored in our world today is called evidential apologetics. You come to a person and you attempt to convince them that there is a God and then ultimately lead them to Christ by showing them the evidence. All right, look, just look around. Look at all this evidence here, this evidence over here, right? This, and this. It's called evidential apologetics. But here's where the problem starts. You can show all the evidence of the world you want to a man who is corrupted of mind, and he cannot interpret the evidence right because his mind is corrupted to begin with. You might have the perfect piece of evidence. Say, like a man walking out of a tomb after being dead for 3 days. Right? You might have the perfect piece of evidence in front of you, and you hold it in front of a man whose mind is corrupted because he's a part of a fallen world. He cannot interpret that right. He doesn't know what to do with it. He draws the wrong conclusions from it because his mind is fallen. You cannot start with evidence because you're starting in a world that's already corrupted. You've got to step outside of the corrupted world in order to make your case, which is what Vantillian presuppositionalism does. Now, I would argue it's not really Vantillian presuppositionalism at all. It's Pauline presuppositional apologetics. It starts in Romans chapter 1, where Paul simply says, listen, here's the deal. There is a God and everybody knows it. There is a creator and everybody knows it. They're doing everything in their power to suppress the knowledge of that creator, but they know in their heart. You start there. You start with the wisdom from above. You cannot start with wisdom from below. The beginning of true wisdom is fear of the Lord, right? Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. The beginning of true wisdom is the recognition that there is a God. That's what it means to fear God. I know He exists. He's deserving of my worship. I am afraid of the fact that He can judge me and destroy me. That's the fear of the Lord. That's the recognition of who this God is. That's where wisdom starts. It doesn't start with attempting to prove something from inside of a corrupted world. It must start with an understanding of God revealing something outside of a corrupted world that in itself is pure, so that it comes to man in that state of purity. Right about here, I could make a pretty good argument that God needed to do that in atonement. Because there's nothing in this world that's pure that could be offered as a perfect sacrifice. So what did God have to do? He had to send the pure one from outside of this corrupted world into it in order to bring atonement. Same thing here. The wisdom of God must first be pure. Everything else then flows from it. Now, what does this word pure then mean? In the simplest sense, pure simply means free from defilement. In many lexicons, it's free from ceremonial defilement, but let's limit it in this case to defilement of any kind, free from defilement of any kind. Other words like holy and sacred and set apart and innocent are other words that are similar to it. We think of it in terms of the purity of the elements, right? Pure gold is gold without anything else in it, although there hasn't been a single ounce of pure gold anywhere in this entire creation, in this entire history, because of the fact you cannot purify absolutely every single atom of impurity out of it. You can try. You can get close. But the fact is that pure means unstained, completely separate, completely one, singular. Now, in this particular case, obviously, it's speaking about a wisdom from above, which implies that it is the reality of God, whereby He is utterly singular in both nature and purpose. We talk about God as being pure. What we mean is that God Himself is utterly pure, utterly singular in both nature and purpose. There is nothing else corrupting or conflated with God in any sort of sense. He simply is all by Himself, a unique being, unstained, unchanged, unaltered by anything outside of Himself, including all of your decisions. Nothing changes who this God is, because He is singular. And not only in His nature, but also in His purpose. He is without stain or error or anything imperfect in either Himself as a being or in His intentions in His decree. Now, there's three possible meanings then to this idea of purity when it applies to wisdom. First, it is a wisdom that comes from one who is pure. So when we talk about the wisdom of God is first pure, we recognize that it is a wisdom that comes from one Himself who is pure, a revelation flowing from perfection itself. The source of true wisdom is God, who is Himself utterly pure. So when James speaks of this knowledge, this wisdom being pure first, he means that it comes from one who is pure. It must come from one who is pure. It must come from one Himself who is utterly pure. Such wisdom, such revelation, is based on the inexhaustible knowledge and understanding of God Himself. The inexhaustible knowledge and understanding of God. Okay, I'm giving you some homework. Here's what I want you to do. Okay, on the way home today, between the time you get in your car and the time you get home, I want you to count the trees that you see along the way. Come back next week and tell me how many there are. No, actually, let me amend that. No, I don't want you to count the number of trees. I want you to count the number of leaves on the trees that you go by. Okay? All right? Now, you come back next week and you tell me how many you saw. And I want an accurate number. I don't want to guess. Okay, so don't Google it and go, how many leaves are there per tree and how many trees are there per acre and per mile? And some of you will do that and figure, I can get rid of it. No, I want an actual number. I want to know a knowledge of what it is that's out there. You can't eat. The homework assignment I just gave you, you're kind of going, I think he's losing it. I think we need to find a new guy. This guy is, he's gone over the edge. Because you and I both know you can't make such a count, can you? But God knows. He knows how many leaves there are in all the trees in all the world. It's beyond our comprehension to imagine such a thing, isn't it? The source of true wisdom is God Himself, whose revelation is based on the inexhaustible knowledge and understanding of God Himself. What that means then is to the believer, the regenerate man, is able to comprehend the world through the eyes of God Himself. Johann Kepler, the great 17th century astronomer, once said that his job was to think God's thoughts after him. He said this, quote, "I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. Since we astronomers are priests of the highest God in regard to the book of nature, it benefits us to be thoughtful, not of the glory of our minds, but rather, above all else, of the glory of God." The job, he said, is to think God's thoughts after him. The Apostle Paul wrote it this way in 1 Corinthians 2. "For who knows the person's thoughts except the spirit of that person, which is in him? So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the spirit of God. Now we have received, not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God." See what he just said? He said what God has given to you is an agent of his knowledge, his own spirit, which knows his mind. When he gives that to us, then we are able to understand the thoughts of the living God. "That we might understand the things freely given us by God, and we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. It is first pure." The knowledge of the wisdom of God is first pure because it comes from the revelation of God. The fallen man can only comprehend the world through his own limited experiences. You can only understand the world through your own limited experiences. If you don't believe me, get an airplane, fly to China, and walk around for a week. You will discover you know nothing about the Chinese people because you have no experience with them. God's revelation comes from the inexhaustible knowledge of God, who himself is pure. Without revelation from a creator, the world is nothing but randomness and chaos. And the world has no answers to deep existential questions. You've got a whole nation of people right now running around looking for answers, and they're looking in all the wrong places. And they're never going to find an answer to the questions, because they're just going to dig deeper into the hole they've already dug. Make any sense? We must look up to the one who is pure first. Second, not only is it that God himself is pure, but the wisdom that comes is pure in itself. It is a revelation that is undefiled in what it reveals. The content of true wisdom is absolute purity. Such wisdom, such revelation is utterly singular in nature because it comes from one who has a singular purpose. What that means for us then as believers, for the regenerate man, that we are able to see the intentions of God in everything that takes place because we know there is a divine purpose behind it all. You see, the fallen man just walks around going, "What's happening? What's happening? What's happening? Do you have any ideas? Do you? Do you have any ideas? Any ideas at all? Anybody? Anybody?" The fallen world spends their life looking around, observing things, trying to decide, where's our answers? But the regenerate man is able to look and say, "Wait, wait. There's intention and purpose in this world, and God is doing what he is doing because he has a decree." You see, without error-free revelation, man is left to search for truth from conflicting sources, including his own error-prone mind and heart. That's why there's 17,000 opinions per Facebook post. It's unfortunate that many Christians today no longer consider the Bible to be the inerrant, infallible revelation of God. And thus, for Christians, they go to and fro throughout the world seeking wisdom from every imaginable sage they can find. Oh, did you read that latest book that came out by so-and-so? Oh, it answers all of your questions about all the things of life. And it's a wonderful book. And I really believe the woman that wrote it, because she is a paragon of knowledge. Except now I've come to find out she's getting divorced. So now I've got to find another sage. So the wisdom that comes from God that is pure because it comes from a source that is pure. And it also comes as a singular message of revelation of God's intentions. But there is a third aspect of this word purity. It is also wisdom that is designed to produce a pure result. It comes from God who is pure, its content is pure, and it's designed to create a pure result, a singular goal. The outcome of true wisdom is experiential purity, which is exactly what it is that Jesus would want to talk to you about if you were sitting at your at the dinner table. Experiential purity. Such revelation, such wisdom accomplishes the singular task into making a people into the fullness of what they were originally intended to be as the image bearers of God. What was God's intention in creating a people that he would create in his own image and send out into the world and then send his son to redeem them from their sin? What was his intention in that? Purity. Purity. To be now conformed to the image, the pure, perfect image that God had for them in creating them. Which means that for those of us who've been born again by the Spirit of God, we understand that the singular intention of God is to make us, stand back, holy. Holy. God's intended purpose is to glorify himself through the process of us being sanctified into the image of Jesus Christ. That is the singular intention and purpose of God in the life of the believer. Now listen, the fallen man, the corrupted man, the unregenerate man hates that with every fiber of his being. He desires to be an autonomous being. He wants to be able to walk around on this planet and say, I answer to no one. I do what I want. I be what I want. If I decide today to wear clothes of the opposite gender, fine, because that's who I am. And you should celebrate that with me because I'm an autonomous being. Which never has made any sense to me. If you're an autonomous being, why do you need me to care what you're doing? But that's how it works, right? The fallen man hates the idea that God's intention in the world is to create a people who are pure and perfect in his sight, born as his image bearers and then reborn by the Spirit of God into creatures being sanctified into a state of glory to spend an eternity with him as pure and holy and righteous. And unscathed by a corrupted world. The fallen man hates that. Now, where that leaves us then is the remaining attributes. They flow from purity. But as you will notice by your watch, I'm out of time. But that's okay, because we really need to talk about these other attributes. Because what we will see now is all the rest of the list flow out of that intention. God's intention as the Holy One to give forth an understanding that itself is pure, which then produces a purity in us. And James is going to say that's what it means to walk by faith. So next week, Lord willing, we'll finish the list.